Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, June 6, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming up on this morning's news, an administrative law judge has ruled that Portland City Council candidate Emily Boyles must repay the public campaign finance money she received. The Army is omitting the Geneva Conventions from its new detainee policy manual, and the European Union policy head has arrived in Tehran to present a series of proposals aimed at persuading Iran to halt nuclear research. And today, 666 is not actually the day of the beast. The number is a result of an incorrect translation of original Greek New Testament. Portland area weather, mostly cloudy in the morning, sunny this afternoon, highs in the mid-70s. Tonight, partly cloudy, becoming mostly cloudy, lows around 50.
An administrative law judge ruled yesterday that Portland City Council candidate Emily Boyles must repay $145,000 she received in public financing and $14,000 in penalties, plus 12% interest. The judge heard Boyles' appeal of the city's action against her during a hearing last week. The city revoked Boyles' candidacy in April after the auditor determined she had violated spending guidelines by prepaying for a one-year lease on her campaign headquarters, paying too much for her daughter's work on the campaign, and using public funds to pay for her home telephone and debts to campaign consultants. The judge's order states, by spending public funds, Boyles was obligated to ensure she spent those funds only on bona fide services and paid no more than a fair market share. Boyles could have, but did not, take responsible steps to ensure that happened. This from the Oregonian.
One of the founders of Oregon's new Working Families Party will discuss the startup political organization tomorrow at Western Oregon University. This according to the Salem Statesman Journal. The presentation by Barbara Dudley will be from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Instructional Technology Center Auditorium. Dudley will discuss the development, goals, and strategies of the party and its fusion voting proposal, which enables multiple parties to endorse the same candidate.
State workplace safety investigators have proposed fining Boise Cascade more than $142,000 for willfully violating workplace safety laws and the death last year of a worker at a wood products plant in Umatilla. Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division announced the proposed fine, its largest in nearly 2 years, this morning. Gordon Cecil of Hermiston was killed this last December while operating machines that converted waste wood into chips to feed a hog fuel burner. Cecil and a co-worker were using a piece of wood to poke at a clog in a chipping machine while the machine's hood guard, meant to protect workers, was raised, according to a press release by the agency. Shortly after hearing the clogged wood release inside the machine, Cecil ran away from the machine and was struck in the back of the head by a log fragment it spit out, the agency said. Oregon OSHA said plant supervisors were aware that safety measures designed to protect workers from serious injury had been bypassed. It cited the company for two willful violations of the Oregon Safe Employment Act. Boise Cascade has appealed the fine. Companies often get proposed penalties reduced during settlement talks with the agency. This from the Oregonian.
Police seized 200 pounds of marijuana worth $150,000 after a traffic stop Sunday on Interstate 5 near Medford, this according to the Oregonian. The bust was among the largest that Oregon State Police have made during a traffic stop, but not the largest. That came last April when state police found 323 pounds of marijuana after stopping a pickup on I-5 near Salem. In the weekend case, Oregon State Trooper Brandon Boyce stopped a pickup for multiple traffic violations, and the drug dog brought to the scene quickly caught the scent of marijuana. With the dog's help, police uncovered 9 separate packages concealed in the truck. An investigation is still underway, and police released the truck driver, a 31-year-old Vancouver man, and he has not been charged in the case yet.
Right-wing tax activist Tim Iman arrived at Washington State Elections Division building yesterday, dressed as Darth Vader and wielding a plastic lightsaber. Missing were the petitions full of signatures in support of an effort to overturn the state's new gay civil rights law. Iman, who has previously dressed up as a gorilla and a prison inmate to tout his various initiative efforts, have been expected to turn in the petitions, but his appearance turned out to be nothing more than a ploy for his publicity machine. Instead, Iman brought boxes of signed petitions for another initiative he is sponsoring for $30 car tabs. The deadline for those signatures isn't until next month, and he was turning any of the signatures in, just bringing them down, as the email promised. The past few weeks, some churches have been running Referendum Sunday in an effort to increase signatures, after Iman sent out an email in which he said he had received less than 10,000 signatures. The law takes effect tomorrow, unless enough valid signatures are turned in, in which case it will be frozen until the election. It makes Washington the 17th state with laws protecting gays and lesbians, and the 7th to protect transgendered people.
Washington Governor Chris Gowar said yesterday that state pharmacy regulators could risk being overruled or worse if they allow druggists' personal objections to interfere with patients' prescriptions. Her comments were aimed at a rule endorsed last week by the State Pharmacy Board that gives pharmacists broad discretion to refuse to fill prescriptions. The board's present draft says pharmacists may not obstruct a patient in obtaining a lawfully prescribed drug or device, and adds druggists must provide timely alternatives if they cannot dispense a prescription. The State Pharmacy Association approves of that stance, but some women's rights advocates say it would allow opponents of morning-after birth control pills to deny the time-sensitive drugs for women who need them. Regulators may take final action in the rule in August, but Gregoire said the board needs to change course quickly to protect patients' rights. Gregoire pledged to help them get the right answer, and she said she's considering her own suggested rule to remedy what she said were policy missteps and vague language in the board's current rule.
Monty Coles was 3,000 feet in the air when he discovered a stowaway peeking out at him from the plane's instrument panel, a 4.5-foot snake. Coles was taking a leisurely flight over the West Virginia countryside in his Piper Cherokee last weekend and was preparing to land in Ohio when the snake revealed itself. Coles attempted to swat the snake, but it fell to the pilot's feet, then darted to the other side of the cockpit. While maintaining control of the single-engine plane with one hand, Coles grabbed the reptile behind its head with his other. Coles said, "There's no way I was letting that thing go," he said. "It coiled all around my arm, and its tail grabbed hold of a lever on the floor and started pulling." The next step was to radio for emergency landing clearance. After a smooth landing, Coles posed for pictures with the snake, then let it loose. He said, "That snake resides in Ohio now."
The Pentagon has decided to omit from new detainee policies a key tenet of the Geneva Convention that explicitly bans humiliating and degrading treatment, according to knowledgeable military officials, a step that would mark a further potentially permanent shift away from strict adherence to international human rights standards. The decision could culminate a lengthy debate within the Defense Department, but will not become final until the Pentagon makes new guidelines public. However, the State Department fiercely opposes the military's decision to exclude Geneva Convention's protections and has been pushing for the Pentagon and White House to reconsider. For more than a year, the Pentagon has been redrawing its policies on detainees and intends to issue a new Army Field Manual on interrogation, which, along with accompanying directives, represents core instructions to U.S. soldiers worldwide. The directive on interrogation, a senior defense official said, is being rewritten to create safeguards so that all detainees are treated humanely but can still be questioned effectively. Bush's critics and supporters have debated whether it is possible to prove a direct link between administration declarations that it will not be bound by Geneva and events such as the abuses at Abu Ghraib or the killings of Iraqi civilians last year in Haditha, allegedly by Marines. But the exclusion of the Geneva provisions may make it more difficult for the administration to portray such incidents as aberrations. And it undercuts contentions that U.S. forces follow the strictest, most broadly accepted standards when fighting wars. This is from the L.A. Times.
The number two American general in Iraq will soon review a preliminary criminal report in the alleged massacre by Marines of Iraq citizens in Haditha. Representative John Klein, one of four House members who traveled to Iraq over the weekend, said the lawmakers discussed the investigations with Lieutenant General Peter Chiarelli, the second reigning U.S. general in Iraq. Klein said it was unclear when the report would be released. A senior defense official told the Associated Press last month that evidence points to unprovoked killings by the Marines involved. A separate probe is examining whether there has been a cover-up of the incident by the U.S. military. The four House members who visited Iraq took the issue with comments made by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who complained that coalition forces have shown no respect for citizens, smashing civilian cars, and killing on a suspicion or a hunch. Klein said his group was told that U.S. military officials and embassy staff have told al-Maliki that his comments were not helpful. Klein also said Iraqi generals told the U.S. lawmakers that they were frustrated about the slow pace in filling the new Iraqi government security posts, saying it was hindering the training of the Iraqi military.
Inflation fears sent stocks plunging yesterday as jitters over high oil prices exacerbated signals that the Federal Reserve will keep lifting interest rates to contain price increases. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sank nearly 200 points. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told an international monetary conference that while rising energy costs have helped slow the pace of economic growth, core inflation, excluding energy and food, was near the central bank's tolerance level and could warrant further rate tightening. The news stunned investors who had grown hopeful that the Fed was almost done raising rates after recent data showed signs that the economy was beginning to cool off. But with Bernanke reiterating the inflation still posed a problem, traders worried about higher interest rates in a slowing economy limiting the potential for stocks to make long-term gains. Stocks were already under pressure from a jump in oil prices fueled by Iran's threat to cut oil exports if Western nations punish or attack the country over its nuclear arms program. Although economists had predicted a dip in the ISM index, the slower growth added to concerns about whether the economy was slowing too quickly. On Friday, a sharply larger than forecast slide in monthly job growth deepened those fears. This is from the LA Times.
The Supreme Court agreed yesterday to decide whether public schools can consider skin color in student assignments, reopening affirmative action in a major case that will turn on the votes of President Bush's new justices. The announcement put a contentious social issue on the national landscape in an election year and could mark a new chapter for a court that famously banned racial segregation in public schools in Brown v. Board of Education. Since then, race questions have been hugely divisive, both for the court and the public. The court's new interest is in public schools, far more sweeping than universities. And O'Connor is gone, replaced by conservative Justice Samuel Alito. The justices will hear appeals from a Seattle parents group and a Kentucky mom who argue that race restrictions improperly penalize white students. At its heart, the court will consider whether school leaders can promote racial diversity without violating the Constitution's guarantee against discrimination.
The Supreme Court yesterday refused to consider the cases of journalists who protected confidential sources for stories about former nuclear weapons scientist Wen Ho Lee, a final note in a legal fight that pitted press freedoms against privacy rights. The court's action, taken without comment, was announced 3 days after the decision of news organizations to pay Lee $750,000 as part of the $1.6 million settlement of his privacy lawsuit against the government. The settlement erased civil contempt of court citations against reporters for refusing to disclose who leaked them information about an espionage investigation of Lee, who was fired from his job at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Lee sued the government for violating his rights under the Privacy Act and said he needed the reporter's testimony to tell him who in the government attempted to smear him as a spy for China. He was never charged with espionage. Justices who could have dismissed the appeal as moot or no longer an issue based on the out-of-court settlement, instead they rejected the appeal which had been filed on behalf of the reporters during the legal wrangling with Lee.
A divided Colorado Supreme Court yesterday upheld Denver's ban on assault weapons, despite arguments that state weapon laws should trump city ordinances. The 3-3 vote, with one justice abstaining, ended a high-profile fight between Colorado's largest city and state officials over two state laws enacted in 2003 that preempted local regulation of firearms in favor of uniform state regulation. The city sued the state, claiming the laws violated its rights to regulate matters of local concern. Denver District Judge Joseph Meyer III ruled in 2004 that the city had to conform to some parts of the state laws, but he said the city could bar the sale of assault weapons and so-called Saturday night specials, despite state laws prohibiting local governments from banning weapons that are otherwise legal under state and federal law. Both the city and the state appealed Meyer's ruling. The Supreme Court said that because of its tie vote, the lower court's ruling stands. It gave no legal opinion or analysis of the issues.
Hoping to speed approval of war funds, House Senate negotiators met last night to try and hasten legislation to pay for the missions in Iraq and Afghanistan and for hurricane relief along the Gulf Coast. After missing a Memorial Day deadline, negotiators hope to seal agreement this week. The White House says a money crunch is threatening the military operation and training, especially for the Army, who could slow training and equipping of Iraqi soldiers. House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jerry Lewis and Senate counterpart Thad Cochran of Mississippi are leading the talks and have agreed to live within a White House demand that the emergency fund will be limited to $92.2 billion for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and hurricanes, plus $2.3 billion to combat bird flu. The overhaul limit has meant dumping or dramatically scaling back Senate initiatives like $4 billion in agricultural disaster assistance to farmers to help them deal with high fuel prices and damage from floods and droughts last year. The move promises to dismay Senate GOP sponsors of the farm aid, such as Conrad Burns of Montana, who's embroiled in a very difficult re-election bid.
New evidence may suggest cover-ups in two separate incidents at the center of a simmering scandal over Iraqi civilian deaths at the hands of American forces. Iraqi anger is percolating over the incidents and over an investigation that cleared U.S. forces in a third case. A brother of a victim, Hashim Ibrahim Ahmad Abbas in Al-Hamadaniya, Iraq, told ABC News that Marines killed his brother needlessly. According to the victim's brother, Marines came to his family's village at 2 a.m. on April 25th and first raided a home where they discovered a shovel and an AK-47. Then they went to his brother's house, dragged him into the street, arrested him, and took him away. A little while later, Abbas's brother heard gunfire outside the village. Waking up at the crack of dawn, he rushed to the police department to report his brother missing. Abbas told ABC News the police informed him that a body had been dropped off earlier by the Americans and that he should go and have a look. It was his brother. Later that day, Marines came to the family home and dropped off the incident report. Eight Marines could face murder charges in the death of Abbas and other charges for possibly attempting to cover up the killing.
And hey, all you Satanists out there, call your tattoo artist and make an appointment now, because that 666 you have somewhere on your skin, it's wrong. You're 5 days late. For centuries, people have been intrigued by the number 666, the number of the beast, from the book of Revelations in the New Testament. Not only is it mentioned in the Bible, it has been associated with Satanism, universal price codes, and the game of roulette, as well as numbers on the wheel, add up to 666. Now, the legendary number is getting a fresh look, as researchers are re-examining evidence the number may actually be 616. Many Bible have footnotes that say the number translated from the original Greek could be 616. Now, experts say that photographic evidence of an ancient fragment of papyrus from Revelation indeed indicates the number is indeed 616 instead of 666. What this means that is if you have Berserker tattooed on your forehead, you are probably right. On the other hand, if you have 666 on your brow, you are wrong. This is from theworldnet.com, Greek New Testament, and other sources.
U.S. authorities tightened their checks of traffic from Canada yesterday as debate over the long and hard-to-police border intensified following the weekend arrest of 17 Muslim Canadians in a suspected Ontario terror plot. Calls for tougher security measures were countered by pleas from business and civic leaders on both sides to keep border crossings as quick and simple as possible. In Washington, U.S. Border Patrol Chief David Aguilar said the patrol stations along the 4,000-mile border are on high alert because of the arrests, although investigators say the suspects' alleged plot apparently involved only targets in Canada. U.S. agents already deployed to the Canadian border will work overtime and some will be moved closer to the areas where the arrest occurred, Aguilar said. U.S. Customs and Border Protection official Christy Clemens said some traffic headed into the United States would undergo tougher procedures at the 89 ports of entry along the border.
EU foreign policy head Javier Solana has arrived in Tehran to present a series of proposals aimed at persuading Iran to halt nuclear research. The proposals were agreed by the five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany last week. The plans have not been made public, but sources say they could include giving Iran a nuclear reactor and assured supply of enriched uranium. Iran says it will consider incentives but refuses to halt uranium enrichment. Solana said at Tehran airport that the West wanted to start a new relationship with Iran on the basis of mutual respect and trust. Shortly before Solana's arrival, Iranian Foreign Minister Manoukher Mottaki said, "If their aim is not politicizing the issue, and if they consider our demand, we can reach a logical agreement." Mottaki told reporters that the EU and Iran would launch a shuttle diplomacy to Iran out differences about Iran's nuclear program. This from the BBC.
An Islamic militia said it has seized Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, after weeks of fighting against an alliance of warlords allegedly backed by the U.S. The warlords have controlled the capital since they toppled Somalia's last effective government 15 years ago. Talks are taking place with fighters still loyal to the warlords, Union of Islamic Quarter officials said. Interim Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi says his government wants to begin dialogue with the group. Earlier, Gedi sacked four powerful Mogadishu-based warlords who'd been serving as ministers. 9 of the 11 Mogadishu-based warlords have now left the city, according to the BBC. This year's clashes in the capital have been the most serious for more than a decade, with some 330 people killed and about 1,500 injured in the past month. Local people in Mogadishu gave a cautious welcome to the news.
President-elect Alan Garcia says Peru's voters sent a clear message to Hugo Chavez: stay out. But with the Venezuelan president's ally Ollanta Humala controlling the largest faction in Peru's Congress, Chavez's populist brand of politics may be there to stay. A moderate leftist, Garcia held an insurmountable lead of 53.2% against 46.8% for Humala, with 92.5% of the vote counted. Many Peruvians saw Humala, who once led a military uprising as an army lieutenant colonel, as unpredictable and dangerous to democracy. They were apparently wary of electing another ally of Chavez, who already has extended his influence to Bolivia, where the AMR Indian Evo Morales was elected president in December. Humala opposes U.S.-backed eradication of coca leaf, the raw material for Peru's thriving cocaine industry, saying no other crop would bring a decent income to the impoverished farmers who grow it. He also is against the U.S.-Peruvian Free Trade Pact and has pledged to increase taxes on foreign mining enterprises, including a huge gold mine owned by American Capital. During the closing days in the campaign, he accused Garcia of being a pawn of American imperialism, this according to The Guardian.
Indonesia sent truckloads of rice to earthquake victims yesterday, while nearby Mount Merapi spewed streams of lava, raising fears of a major eruption threatening thousands of people living on the slopes of the volcano. The volcano has been erupting for months, but activity has increased since the 6.3 magnitude quake struck central Java Island on May 27th, killing at least 6,000 people. Aid agencies stepped up supplies of food, clean water, and latrines, but warned unsanitary conditions could lead to a wave of diarrhea and skin diseases, as well as infections. Merapi, one of the world's most active volcanoes, is about 50 miles north of the epicenter of the powerful quake, and its activity has increased since the Temblor. Its lava dome has swelled since the quake to 330 feet, raising fears that it could collapse, officials said. That could send searing hot clouds of gas and debris pouring down the slopes into inhabited areas, the government has warned. Authorities have ordered residents in the danger zone to evacuate the area, but many have refused to abandon their livestock and crops.
New Iraqi government documents show that, excluding the nearly daily bombings, more Baghdad residents died in shootings, stabbings, and other violence in May than in any other month since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. The numbers and accounts from residents depict neighborhoods descending further into violence and fear, this according to the LA Times. Last month, nearly 1,400 bodies were brought to the central morgue, according to the Ministry of Health statistics. The count doesn't include soldiers or civilians victims of explosions on whom autopsies are not usually conducted. Since 2003, more than 30,000 bodies have been brought to the morgue. Bodies often lie in the streets for hours. Residents in some areas fear death squads and Shiite-dominated security forces. In other parts of town, they worry about religious extremists who have threatened to kill men who wear shorts and women who drive or leave their hair uncovered.
Gunmen in police uniforms abducted more than 50 people from a street in central Baghdad yesterday afternoon in a swift attack that unfolded in shadow of Iraq's Ministry of Justice building. Many of the 56 people seized in the coordinated operation were workers on the street where several bus companies offer transport to Syria and Jordan, witnesses and police said. Others were passengers aboard the buses, Syriana businessmen going home, some Palestinians, and a number of Iraqis feeling insecurity in their homeland. That very insecurity was on display as men in masks and camouflage fatigues shoved the abductees at gunpoint into waiting pickup trucks. Kidnappings and killings take place with terrifying regularity in Baghdad, but the raid was unusually brazen even by the capital's standards. The attack did not appear to be motivated by sectarian rivalry, however, a witness said. In another development in Baghdad Monday, a court sentenced an Iraqi man to life imprisonment in connection with the 2004 abduction and killing of Iraqi-British aid worker Margaret Hansen. Mustafa Solomon, charged with aiding and abetting the abductors, received the sentence a few hours after his trial started. The two other defendants in the case were freed. The trial was believed to be the first in Iraq for the abduction or murder of a foreign-born civilian.
And albatrosses on islands in the South Atlantic are being pushed to the brink of extinction, according to research. Populations of three species breeding on South Georgia and outlying islands have declined by about a third in the past 30 years. Conservation groups say the major threat to the bird futures is deep-sea fishing using a line with a number of baited hooks attached to it. Up to 100,000 albatrosses a year drown on longline fishing hooks, they added. Three species of albatross breed in and around South Georgia, the wandering or great albatross, the black-brown albatross, and the gray-headed albatross. Numbers of the wandering albatross are down by nearly a third since 1984, with similar losses for the other two species, according to research by the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds and BirdLife International, this from the BBC.
Climate researchers at Purdue University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology separately reported new evidence last week supporting the idea that global warming is causing stronger hurricanes. That claim is the subject of a long-running scientific dispute, and while the new research supports one side, neither the authors nor other climate experts say it is conclusive. In one new paper to appear in a coming issue of Geophysical Research Letters, Matthew Huber of the Purdue Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences and Ryan Shriver, a graduate student there, calculate the total damage that could be caused by storms worldwide. The pair used data normally applied to reconciling weather forecast models with observed weather events. In a statement accompanying the release of the study, Huber said the results were important because of the overall measure of cyclone activity, whether through more intense storms or more frequent storms, had doubled with a 1/4 degree increase in average global temperature. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, June 6, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Matt Bingley is our engineer this morning. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on Translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on Translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Want to know what goes on in the KBOO Morning News? Volunteer in the AM newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. And Portland area weather today, mostly cloudy in the morning, sunny this afternoon, highs in the mid-70s. Tonight, partly cloudy, becoming mostly cloudy, lows around 50. And coming up this morning on KBOO at 7.